Broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria, you're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each Friday and listen to the guys from UGC discuss current events, share markets, real estate, personal finance, politics, and the economy. Now here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
And a very good Friday morning to all of our listeners. I'm your host, Stephanie Sumner, and welcome to the podcast today. Guys, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, look, has anyone been following the royal visit? Anyone been watching it?
By default, not by design.
Is that Dame Beams back to Collingwood?
That's the biggest news of the week, isn't it?
That's the royal visit, isn't
we
it?
We can never get off the football, can we?
No, tell us about the royal visit. What's going on there?
Just that Meghan Markle was in Melbourne yesterday. And look, I'm not really a royalist, but I've got to say I do have a bit of a girl crush on Meghan Markle. So, I thought she did a really, really good job. And I think she's doing really well with her duties. And I know that she got paid out a little bit on the news for acting, but it must be pretty hard being in that kind of a position.
Well, she's not my favourite person because she's basically killed the plot on Suits by leaving.
Well, don't tell me because I'm still to get to that part.
Okay.
Yeah. We've crash-coursed on six series so far this year.
Oh, you're not far away from the critical moment then.
So you can't tell us what the end is?
No.
No, well, there isn't an end, but obviously there's a change.
Yeah.
I hope she dies rather than a breakup.
Oh, gosh, that's a bit dramatic.
I'll let you go through it and find out.
The thing about the royals is there's so much written about it. I mean, one thing I did read about it is about the jeans that Meghan Markle was wearing.
I didn't read that. Tell me more, Louis.
She was wearing a pair of jeans, which is made by a company with a social cause, mm-hmm. About helping homeless people and children in poverty. And so there was an article about the jeans she was wearing.
Yeah.
And, you know, wonderful cause, great thing, but I'm not sure I need to read about
it's
the jeans
fascinating
she's wearing.
How much of it makes the news, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, that's the amazing thing with both her and Kate. Whenever they go out in public, the clothing they wear seems to have a massive effect on the supplier, and their websites are obviously crashing and they sell it out. So, great sponsorship opportunity if you can get it.
There you go.
I think the interesting part about them is that they're a bit young and a dynamic sort of a couple of couples, really, this sort of makes news because they're interesting instead of being boring old royals.
Prince Charles and Camilla. God, give me a break there.
And Harry's been a colourful character over his life.
He has been a colourful character. I think that's the appeal, isn't it?
Yeah.
That he's a little bit more normal.
Yeah. He looks like someone you could go and have a beer with and enjoy it.
I'd like to have a beer with Harry.
I think it'd be a bit of fun.
We might reach out to him before he heads back.
I would have preferred to have 10 beers with Harry 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Would have been an interesting night out.
Yeah, in his Las Vegas hotel room. That would be a bit of fun, I reckon.
Okay, so moving on. What's on your mind this week, apart from beers in hotel rooms?
And Dame Beams.
Well, we've got the correction still going on in the stock market. We had a... so obviously last week we spoke about the fact that global equity markets had a bit of a pullback, around about 7 to 8%, depending on what index you're looking at. We had a strong rally on Tuesday, and today we've had another bit of a dip back again. The NASDAQ is down about 2%. This is actually very normal price action for a stock market correction. Typically what you would see is that you don't tend to make one low before the market starts to rally more sustainably. You tend to see a test to that previous low. When we had that low last week, we had a rally for the last few days, and now it looks like we're going to test that low that we experienced last week. And that's a good thing. Often what happens is that you end up getting a low, a secondary low that just undercuts the previous low, and then you often get a very sharp rally, if this is no more than a typical correction or stock market pullback. And it appears to be that we're now having that second test. Interestingly enough, we have had some research come out from Stansbury Research, and they've gone back and had a look at what tends to happen when we see extreme periods of market weakness. And in particular, they had a look at the periods of time over the last almost 70 years when the US stock market has fallen 6 days in a row. Now, last week was six consecutive days of declines on the S&P 500. And they've gone back and had a study of how often that happens and what likely happens in the next 3, 6, and 12 months after such a extended period of declines. Now, what they found was that 6 days of declines only happens about 1% of the time. So if you think about it, it actually happens, if it's 70 years of data that they're looking at, it's happening probably around about 1.3 years, once every 1.3 years or so. And what they found was that while most people think that this is actually a very negative and bearish sign, and that you know, a consecutive period of declines could actually precede further declines as you know, the stock price movements to the downside could accelerate, the evidence actually suggests something very much to the contrary. In fact, when you see such extremes, this has actually preceded a significant period of outperformance over a 3-month, 6-month, and 12-month period after that decline. So what they said was that 76% of the time you end up higher 12 months later, and on a 3-month basis, the market is up around about 3.5% on average, versus the standard average return of about 1.9%. So it outperforms over a 3-month basis to the upside. After 6 months, the outperformance is, or the performance of the stock market is 5.4% relative to the long-term average of 3.8. And over 12 months, the stock market is higher on average 11.3% after the 6-day decline, relative to an average rate of appreciation of 7.7%. Now, this is just price appreciation, not dividends.
Okay, and that that appreciation they're talking about, though, that's coming from the lower base after the decline, isn't it?
Correct.
So yep. I guess if you factored in where it dropped from, it may not be as great an increase?
Well, what it's basically saying is that if you were to buy today, you are going to generate, on average, a much higher rate of return than the average rate of return that the stock market gives you. Now, we're only down around about 7% from the peak. Okay, so if you're up 11%, then you're going to be you're going to be a decent percentage above where the previous high was. So what it's basically saying is that 76% of the time, you're going to be higher 12 months later than where you are today.
That's pretty high probability.
And generally, you're going to be high by about 11.3%, and which would generally mean that you're hitting new highs 12 months down the track. So now the key thing to note is that that's a stock market average. Now, obviously, there's going to be winners and losers to come up with that average.
Yep.
So, you know, if you can sort of position yourself for the better performing industries and sectors, then there's a chance that you could do actually better than 11.3%. And remember, that's just price appreciation. So if you throw on top, you say 2.5% as a dividend yield, which is what the S&P 500 has generally generated over the long term, you're sort of looking at close to almost just shy of 14% as a total return 12 months later. So odds are on our side that this is just a very short-term pullback, and we're getting close to probably seeing the bottom in the next week or so, and we're back on track for higher prices over the course of the next 12 months.
Well, and more than that, it sounds like now's a really good time to be getting in.
Very much so, yep. Mm.
Joel, you're saying that because you know the fundamentals look good as well. You're not just looking at these price actions and statistics and making an assumption on that. Last week we talked about the fundamental signals that make us bullish on where the stock market is headed.
Absolutely. So, I mean, you know, it's only 76% of the time that it rises more, you know, and that means that one out of every four times it's actually lower over 12 months. But when you have very sound fundamentals, economic fundamentals like we have today, and you've still got the US stock market and some other stock markets, I wouldn't say most stock markets, but you've got other stock markets around the world that are certainly in an uptrend still, you would have to say that the odds significantly favour the fact that you're going to fall into the 3 out of 4, not the 1 out of 4.
Absolutely. I mean, here in Australia, we've just had reports of the unemployment rate declining. You've talked before about corporate profits are still very strong and healthy in the US and in Australia. Yep. So, there's some strong fundamentals.
I was actually talking to a friend last night about the health of the economy, and everyone in Australia just seems to want to actually talk down how good things actually are out there. You know, I mean, like, we actually had the unemployment rate come out just this week, and we've gone from 5.3% down to 5% unemployment just this week. Now, yeah, there's a little bit of a drop in the participation rate, but things are actually still pretty good, you know? Like, I mean, there seems to be a lot of doom and gloom about, you know, how Australians feel about the economy and their own personal circumstances.
Do you think that's just, you know, that's just psychological though? I mean, people, it's better for them to say that in case it does go that way, and then they feel better if it, you know, if it does happen.
They're guarding against it.
Yeah, of course.
I don't know.
I think it's what people are experiencing.
Yeah.
Because firstly, they read it in the media, and secondly, most people haven't suddenly become employed after a period of unemployment. Certainly for those people who are now employed, with that unemployment rate dropping, they're obviously better off. But for most people who already have jobs, what we're not seeing at the moment and haven't seen in a while is significant pay rises. Funnily enough, what we are seeing is employers giving more benefits that are not pay. They're giving more flexible arrangements, they're giving more gym memberships and healthy living incentives and things like that, but they're not seeing wage rises on a huge basis.
Yeah, that's true. But overall, I mean, things are actually pretty good. I mean, at 5%, lower than 5%, you start to get into almost full employment.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, we're not far away from full employment, you know.
Yeah. So. Well, that low interest rates, it's not a bad time.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay, we better move on to our roundtable conversations. We might kick off with you, Brett.
Okay.
You've got, you're going to talk about the plan to decentralise Melbourne by creating mini cities. Tell us more.
Yeah, sure. So an article from the ABC just this week mentioned a plan that both the Coalition and Labor have to create alternative CBDs around Melbourne, or what they're going to call national employment and innovation clusters. As Melbourne's gotten bigger over the last few years and it's growing quite rapidly and getting towards 5 million, we just don't have the infrastructure to support people getting in and out of the city, and traffic's becoming a real burden. So the plan would be to have more jobs in remote, not so much remote areas, but located sort of in that belt outside the CBD. So they've got seven areas that they see these little clusters happening. So Werribee's one.
Oh, Werribee, right.
Yep. Sunshine be another. La Trobe University in the north.
Wow.
Parkville, which is still quite close. Fishman's Bend is almost part of the CBD. Monash University in Clayton, where there's already a medical hub and the university out there. And also Dandenong, which is one of the outer suburbs. So
Great idea.
Behind it all, would be to have them become mini CBDs with more and more jobs, so that they could have people from those local areas be there. And less travel times.
It'd be a cheaper option too for a lot of companies to move their offices further out.
Potentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Depending on what they can find.
So now, it's kind of like a Parramatta.
That's interesting you bring that up, because some of the things they mentioned in the article here was that multiple CBDs have been in Sydney's plan for years.
Yep.
So this is relatively new for Melbourne's plan. But there's some arguments up there to say whether it's actually worked, based on Parramatta being the examples. So it says Parramatta has been developing as a CBD since the 70s. And that was when the Australian Tax Office was relocated there in the 70s. One person from the Grattan Institute points out that as proof that the alternative CBD doesn't actually work, Parramatta only has 2.3% of Sydney's jobs.
Right, okay.
So whether that stat alone, you know, is able to really identify whether it's worked or not, because in Melbourne, what percentage of all of Melbourne's jobs do you think are in the CBD?
Well, I don't know. I can't imagine.
It's a hard one.
Yeah.
It's a tough one.
It is.
I'd have to take a stab in the dark at 70%.
Okay. You're miles off, to be honest.
Am I?
Wow.
Yeah.
Are we including, I mean, Melbourne specifically, Melbourne CBD and Docklands?
Yeah,
and
CBD, South Bank and Docklands.
Yep.
So it doesn't say St Kilda Road, but CBD, okay. South Bank and Docklands.
Yep. Oh, I'd say it'd be less than 10%.
Really? No, it's a bit just above that.
Okay.
Yeah. It's 15.5%.
Wow.
Melbourne CBD.
Jeez, I would have been with you. I would have thought it was a lot more.
More than
and I was the same. I would have thought it'd be a significant amount. But yeah, so there's a lot of small businesses, factories, warehousing in some of the middle and outer suburbs.
Well, sorry, Brett, what's that number again?
15.5%.
15.5%. So, okay, let's say Parramatta is 2.something%, as an example. Melbourne wants to create seven mini CBDs. Let's say each one of them takes 1% of the future workforce.
Yeah.
Now Melbourne CBDs is down from 15% down to what, 8%?
or maybe it stays at 15%.
True.
And
it's grown to 20%. Yeah.
Maybe it's just, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats, that these outer areas just have to have more jobs because of population growth. The percentage stays still in the around the major CBD.
Very interesting.
It's sort of interesting with Docklands, though. They've tried to make that into a mini city. We were down there the other day, and it is still developing. I mean, it's still not, doesn't have the greatest feel down that.
But in terms of jobs and institutions, though, it's become virtually the new financial
precinct.
That's
why all the banks are down there.
Myer's
headquarters.
I think there's also a difference between Parramatta over the last three decades and the future. Because jobs are a lot less decentralised in general. Head offices in the past have to be a place where people will meet. If I think of our business as financial planners, we have a lot of clients coming into our office because we need to have those face-to-face meetings. But going forward, there's a lot of businesses, a lot of industries that don't need that face-to-face anymore, which means more businesses than ever before are less bound to being in the CBD.
And especially as better internet comes about.
That's right. Yeah. And if I was thinking of internet companies specifically, actually. Yep. I mean, iiNet's head office is out in Camberwell. Is Coles's head office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you've got major companies that don't need to be in the CBD.
Yep.
And if they can, if these sort of suburban CBD areas can attract some major tenants, then that's where the jobs go.
It's also the flexibility now of working from home. I mean, certainly in my business, on a Friday, there's no one sort of around. People are working from home and, you know, we've moved to hot desking and there seems to be quite a lot of space on the floor. So it's not needing to actually have such a large building anymore either.
That's right.
Well, and as you said with those companies, Louis, the plans for one of these sort of precincts for Werribee seems to have got the most momentum up at the moment, and multi-billion dollar companies, including IBM and Cisco, are reportedly interested in moving there.
Okay.
So,
amazing.
Look, it doesn't look like it's anything that's going to happen quickly. I mean, the report sort of suggests over the next 30 years, these mini CBDs could pop up.
Yeah, okay.
Brett, how do they do it? How does the government put in place policies that encourages businesses to move out?
The obvious one that I've seen used overseas is tax zones.
Yeah.
So if you move your head office to a particular zone, you get preferential tax treatment or discounted tax rates.
Do you think that would affect any of the big businesses staying in the city, though? If there was such, you know, motivation to go out into a different area, would we see a drop in sort of the corporates in the CBD?
I think what you'll find is that, and this is what I think has happened with some of the financial institutions, they are often just continuing to have their front, you know, client-facing positions still
in the
offices, but they're moving all of their back office to cheaper locations. Like, I know that Macquarie, I believe, has a fairly strong back office operational area up in Brisbane. Wages are cheaper, rent is cheaper, but they still have to have and maintain a presence here in Australia, but they don't have to have in Melbourne or Sydney, but they don't have to have such a bigger footprint.
But would that affect the economy in the CBD? Do you think this will have any impact or not?
Oh, probably not the economy in the CBD.
No, I wouldn't think so.
It's more about taking away those bottlenecks and those pressures more than anything else, which is good for the CBD.
Yep. Geelong wasn't mentioned on that list either, was it?
No, I think it's not necessarily referring to any regional. It's just more a matter of within the metropolitan area of Melbourne, how can they build more what was the word they called it? It's not CBDs, they called
mini-cities.
National Employment and Innovation Cluster.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's really just trying to create jobs to be more in these locations. And interestingly, the one that I thought would be there, because I've seen a number of significant buildings going up there for commercial purposes, is Box Hill.
Okay.
You know, the tax office built a huge building there, and there's a lot more population. So I would have thought that would be one, but it's not one of the ones listed.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that like 4 or 5 years ago, there was another list of cities that were earmarked to be those sort of mini cities. And I heard that it was like Frankston, Ringwood, Franks and Ringwood, Footscray, I think Geelong was one of them.
Now, there was a separate thing, and I don't have it now, but about where they saw, like, the there were certain precincts that they said had the attributes to be able to accommodate more growth of population with our activity and transport hubs.
Okay, and so maybe that's what I'm referring to. Yep.
So I remember Caulfield was one where you've had the convergence of the train line and the major roads.
Yes, okay.
And, yeah, so that might have been the one you were referring to.
Right.
Fair and Brett, did they give a timeline on this?
Oh, well, the only part of the report is, you know, over 30 years.
Over 30
but
years,
it looks like the people of Werribee are the ones that are pushing the hardest. They probably want to see this happen. I guess the thing I thought was interesting in it, that if we believe this is likely to happen over time, affordable housing is going to come into the equation, because some of these outer areas, you know, there'll be more development coming on and typically land will be cheaper. But over time, the values of those will grow if these employment centres take off.
Mm. Yeah, I can't see how the West can remain undeveloped like it is at the moment. Like that whole stretch all the way down to Geelong, that is just all that vacant land. I mean,
over
20 years' time, I'm sure that's just going to be filled with estates.
Yeah, well, I think it'll get to Werribee. At the moment, you know, there's still gaps between, you know, Wyndham Vale's taken off. There's still gaps out to Werribee.
Yeah.
I think if that gradually fills up all the way to Werribee, that's just a lot of housing.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, and it's more than likely going to happen.
We'll watch this space and see if it does develop.
Yep.
All right, so we better move on to the next topic, and we'll head over to Louis, and you're going to speak about how much guarantees cost us in life.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm always talking about personal finance and the impact on the consumer and that sort of thing. And I got to thinking, in life, when we want a guaranteed outcome, we usually have to pay a premium for it.
Mm.
Now, as humans, our decisions, when we make a decision, we are very bad at judging risk. Our decisions ultimately come down to how we feel about something, so emotions drive our decisions. Mm-hmm. We try to use logic and research and facts to change our emotion and change our decision, but ultimately it's emotion that drives the decision, how we feel about something. So, I mean, my personal experience is when I'm buying a fridge to go in my house, you know, I do the research, I get the right dimensions, all the right specs and things, and then try and find the lowest cost with a decent brand. And, you know, it comes down to the last couple of $100 and I choose something, you know, that's right in my price as that cost. So let's say it's a $900 fridge. And then the last option at the checkout, whether it's online or with the salesperson in the store, is, do you want the extended warranty with that?
Mm-hmm.
Because it comes with a one-year warranty, but what about a three-year warranty or what about a five-year warranty? So do you want some kind of guarantee that this product will last more than 12 months, and if it doesn't, then we'll replace it free of charge? Well, how much does that guarantee cost? How much do you guys think, you know, in your own experience?
As a percentage of the price?
Say on a $900 purchase, what would you expect an extended warranty to cost?
$150, $200?
Yeah.
$150 to $200
For what, 3 to 5 years?
Yeah. Yep, I'd agree. Now that's a serious premium.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm. If 10 people take up that guarantee, there's not 1 in 10 fridges that are going to blow up in 3 to 5 years.
No.
There's probably not 1 in 20. Probably not 1 in 50.
Yeah.
You're talking, you know, 1 or 2 out of. Probably 1 out of 100.
And if your fridge does blow up, it's likely that you've lost the paperwork and can't remember where you actually put the guarantee.
That too.
Exactly.
So these guarantees, if we make that same decision for our fridge, microwave, couch, all our consumer items, and we end up paying an extra 10% for everything that we buy, these guarantees in life end up costing us a huge amount.
And insurance is alive and well.
And the insurance industry is alive and well, very profitable.
Mm.
So, Laurie, can I ask you then, do you think that you need to be careful on selecting the guarantees that you think that you should have in your life? Like, I'm just thinking when you're talking about the fridge blowing up, what about travel insurance when something could potentially go wrong and you think, well, that's probably an important one to have?
Well, it depends on what risks can you afford to take. So, you know, if I spend $900 on a fridge, what's the risk if the fridge does actually blow up in the 13th month?
Yeah.
Well, the risk to me is I have to spend another $900 on a new fridge. Can I afford that risk? I mean, it's not nice, but yeah, I could pull out another $900 in a year's time.
Yeah,
that's not going to change my life.
Yeah.
Whereas with travel insurance, what's the amount of risk? Well, it's a very low probability, but if I had a car accident overseas and I'm injured, then I could, let me think of the USA. If I'm in a hospital in the USA and they slap me with one of those bills, and I don't know if you guys have heard the stories of
$100,000
bills. What would I do to deal with a $100,000 bill? I can't just come up with $100,000. So I need that protection.
Lower risk but higher impact.
Exactly.
And travel insurance is actually relatively affordable as well.
Yeah, it is. But that's because the probability is so low. Still a very profitable industry, but what's the potential magnitude of money that I can lose? So travel insurance, that's a good idea.
Health insurance, because I often complain, oh, the premiums are so high, I have to pay this every year, it's going up and up and I never use it. And I bet you the time that I decide, well, I won't have that policy in place or something will go wrong.
Yeah, that's right. But again, what's the amount of money that you can claim on health insurance?
But how often do you claim on it? Because often I go and get you know, my neck worked on or something and I forget to actually put it down as a claim.
That's right. And not so much for those little things, because again, those little things you can afford. You'd rather the insurance company pay for it, but you can still pay 50 bucks or 80 bucks for your medical consultations.
But they sell you up to the top premium and you go, oh, I'll have that because it's, you know, the duck's guts, as Joel would call it. And then you don't actually use it. So.
Well, yeah, of course, of course. But I am more conscious of what about the $10,000 health events? What about the $20,000 health events? Yeah. That's where it comes in for me. But then when the cost is what it is, if it's $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 per year, then, you know, wouldn't you rather put that money into a bank account and save it, and then you've got the money? But then there's the tax incentive. So health insurance is a bit different because there's, for a lot of people, a tax incentive to have it as well.
Yeah, I often say to clients, if you can't afford to lose it, then you should insure it. And if you can't afford to insure it, you can't afford to have it.
Yeah, right.
Mm. Yep.
Good principles to live by.
Yeah. So, I mean, another one is car insurance. If you've got a $50,000 car, then yes, insurance is a nice idea. But in a worst case scenario, if you wrote off that car completely, maybe you shouldn't go and buy another $50,000 car. Maybe you would buy a $20,000 car. Is it going to be the end of the world if you do that? Maybe you need a car loan to do it. But if you can go without the car insurance, well, then you're saving maybe $2,000 a year if it's an expensive car. Maybe $1,000 a year for a less expensive car. You're not going to write a car off once every 20 years.
Wouldn't think so.
You'd hope not. But there's a risk.
Yeah.
So I'm
sure there's people that have.
I see much more value in...
He hasn't seen my driving.
Travel insurance, life insurance, disability insurance. My insurances that have the potential to pay out hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
That's looking at.
Better value.
Yes, you want a guarantee. And even then, only because you have to.
And interestingly, Hugh... Louis, on your the fridge scenario, I was reading something only recently that apparently there's something within the Australian consumer law that a lot of products must be valid or fit for purpose for at least 2 years. So even though you might say it's only got a warranty of a year and you'll be upsold an extra year, that extra year you're actually paying for something you've already got.
Right.
So well, I don't know absolutely, but I did read it somewhere. I thought, well, that's interesting.
I do know that consumer law has been upgraded because in the past warranties have been such a fickle thing. So they brought in legislation to standardise it. And I think Apple was a company that really fought against it because they had a 12-year warranty and law then required them to up it to 2 years and they refused to do it and not complying with law, blah, blah, blah. But it's an expectation now that when you buy something that it's going to last. So now guarantees extend to the financial world as well.
Definitely.
Because when you look at a guarantee on a rate of return on any investment that you choose, what's the type of investment where you get a guaranteed rate of return?
Term deposit.
Term deposits. Perfect. So what have term deposit rates been over the last
Pitiful.
1, 2, 3 years? Pretty terrible.
You could pay for that fridge guarantee with it.
That's right.
About $150.
It's, you know, been 2 to 2.5% for a good number of years. Now, if you just take a little bit of extra risk, I would look at fixed income investments. Mm. Here's how I'd describe your expectations with fixed income investments. If you put your money into a fixed income investments over 3 years, you're probably going to get 100% of your money back.
Yep.
It's going to be in the range of 99% to 101% of your money back after 3 years.
Yep.
Small chance it would be a 2% difference. Really outside chance it would be a 3% difference. Mm. So realistically, you're looking at that much money back. That's a little bit of risk because there is that little bit of capital movement. There is a chance that you could lose 1%, maybe 2%, maybe even 3% of your money. But what do you get? You get a higher interest rate on that investment. It's not an interest rate that's guaranteed up front, but over many, many, many years, the general rule is you get about 1% more than term deposit rates. Mm, mm,
mm. At the moment, the spread between, and if you get yourself a good fixed income manager and bond manager, some of our bond managers that we utilise are getting, you know, 5.5% to 6%.
That's good.
And this is all in, you know, a diversified portfolio of high grade corporate debt. Now, yes, it's not backed by the government and it's not guaranteed by the government, which term deposits and at-call savings accounts are. But when you compare, you know, 5.5% to 6% versus 2.5%, you know, even if you blended some of that, you know, together, you can still get a substantially higher return with
well, it's fairly more than double the return.
Yeah, with a fairly commensurate level of risk.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so, what's the liquidity on those sorts of investments?
As good as, well, you know, 5 days to 10 days.
Yep. Yep. Which is actually better than term deposits.
Yeah.
Because with a term deposit, you're locking your money in.
Yep.
You can't get it for the period of time that you lock it in.
Mm. Yep.
Unless you break the term deposit, in which case you forfeit a chunk of the interest.
Mm-hmm. And there's guarantees in property as well, especially on new property where people want a rental guarantee.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, and that comes at a cost to some degree. A lot of the time it's hidden and you don't really realise it. But, you know.
Yep.
There's an associated cost.
Yeah,
to
you're
it.
Exactly right. I mean, it's going to be bundled into the purchase price in some way.
Or there's something wrong with the property as to why they're giving it.
Yep, that's right. And whether it's a property developer or Defence Force Housing Association or anything like that, it means there is a risk factor and they are eliminating that risk. Mm. Therefore, they need to have additional money in their pocket to take on that risk on your behalf. So that's what I wanted to talk about today. Looking out for what guarantees you are taking out in your life and having a rethink of those, what are the guarantees that you can afford to live without?
Yeah.
Because it's going to put more money in your pocket.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Great advice.
Yeah, well done.
All right. Now, moving on to Joel. You're going to speak to us today about US private equity funds competing with the big banks.
Yeah. So, we've got the housing... slowdown that's going on, and this is being led by a withdrawal and a tightening of lending standards by the major banks, basically. And this is just a classic example of, you know, economics, capitalism working the way it should. As the banks are withdrawing from the market, you're having non-bank lenders come in and fill that void. And in actual fact, we're seeing some real heavyweights enter the Australian mortgage market to try and sop up the demand for credit that is out there. I mean, people still want to borrow. It's just that they just can't get access from the majors to the amount of money that they were previously getting access to 12, 18, 24 months ago.
Yep.
Some major investment houses have stepped into the Australian mortgage market to sop up that demand. So we hear a lot of doom and gloomers saying, well, with the banks pulling out, this is going to be catastrophic and it's going to lead to... We had Shane Oliver come out just this week saying that the housing market's going to fall by 20%. Well, thanks, Shane Oliver. I mean, I don't even think you predicted the sun waking up this morning.
He does come out with crackers every now and again, doesn't he?
Yeah.
There'll be no sunlight for the next 2 days.
Yeah, you know. I mean, Shane Oliver and his predictions. Yeah, good on you.
But this isn't entirely new, though, because you've had, like, Wizard and places like that are non-bank lenders in the market, but it sounds like there's just more of them potentially coming in now.
Yeah, well, actually, you've had some significant overseas investment houses that have stepped in.
Who are they, Joel?
KKR. Has anyone heard of Barbarians at the Gates?
Yeah, of course.
The book that came out in the 80s. Yep. Yeah, big private equity firm, Corporate Raider. Well, they've stepped in and they've taken a big stake in, who have they purchased? They've purchased
Peppers.
Yeah, yeah, Peppers, that's Pepper right. Money. And then we've had Blackstone step in. And
another big one.
Another big one. Blackstone is actually the biggest private equity firm in the world. They've stepped in and bought 80% of La Trobe Financial Services.
Wow.
Wow.
All right, so...
And La Trobe are probably the biggest non-bank lender, I'd say, around Australia. They're very active.
Most definitely.
Yeah.
And then we've had Cerberus Capital have stepped in and purchased Bluestone. Now, Bluestone are relatively small compared to La Trobe and Peppers. But
And I think those ones you're mentioning are still active in the SMSF space where the majors are pulled out.
They are, yes, yes indeed.
Are they offering the same types of lending, though, that the banks are?
Well, traditionally, the banks would lend primarily to prime borrowers.
Yep.
And these guys would usually lend to non-prime borrowers. Yeah, low doc. They'd usually
higher risk.
Yep.
Self-employed with minimal taxable income.
Yeah, correct. But now what's happening is that these guys are now actually taking more than 50%, they're writing more than 50% of mortgage-backed security loans. So basically, the banks used to write a lot of loans and they used to package these up, sell them off to investors. Now, these guys are now coming in and writing more than half of the loans that are being packaged up and sold off to investors today because non-bank lenders can't take deposits. Okay, so that's the difference. So what they do is they fund their loans through investors who want to actually invest in mortgages and get a secure rate of return on securities that are backed by collateral in housing. But what this is clearly showing is that, while everyone wants to focus on the doom and gloom and the banks are pulling in credit and tightening up credit, the free market is working. And we're getting a whole range of new lenders stepping in to fill that void. And and this is what happens. This is how things adjust. And, it reminds me of we had the peak oilers back in the mid-2000s saying that the world is going to run out of oil. And sure enough, as soon as, we're seeing $140 oil prices, people go to innovate new ways to extract oil from the ground. And yes, whatever you want to call it with regards to the environment, hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling came in, and all of a sudden we saw oil prices go from $140 back in 2008 down to $25 only a few years ago.
Well, humans are pretty resourceful, aren't we? We do find a way when we're told that there is no way forward.
When there is a demand, we tend to find innovative ways to fill that demand and come up with new ways to supply it. Yeah. And
Which is progress.
So. Yeah, that's right. So, it's fascinating that...
And it's capitalism.
This is how it works. This is how it works. So just a great example of capitalism working the way it should. I think it's another example as to why we shouldn't have to be so pessimistic about the housing market going forward.
Not being doom and gloom, though, here, but could it potentially go wrong on that end with the way they're actually, packaging and giving people loans in that, I know it's private.
It could, but there's fairly significant laws even for non-bank lenders to abide by when it comes to assessing loans as well. So, they've got some fairly stringent credit standards that they have to abide by. And in fact, if you have a look at the rates of default on these types of loans that non-banks are actually experiencing, they're at 12-year lows. We're not seeing even non-conforming lows, these low-doc loans... The amount of those loans that are defaulting are less than where we were in 2006. We're seeing around about 4% of those loans in arrears. Back in 2006, we're seeing around about 11% of those.
But is that because we have such a great employment level at the moment?
And low interest rates, I'd imagine.
That and low interest rates.
What happens if that changes, Joel?
Well, the trend has been down, though, for the best part of 10 years. We saw non-conforming loans peak in terms of arrears up at around about sort of 16% of those back in 2009, 2010. And over the last decade, we've seen them fall down to about 4%, the lowest they've been in a decade. Mm-hmm. So we're not seeing stress in the mortgage market.
Well, I've got some other stats that support what you're saying here, Joel, too, around the delinquency rates that are current. So as of this week, talks about the haves and the has-nots as where mortgage stress seems to hit harder in terms of areas and demographics.
Yep.
And funnily enough, the closer you are to the CBD, the less likely you're in delinquency with your mortgage.
Yep.
And as you move further out, the higher and higher the rate gets. But the rate is as low as around 1.2% closest to the CBDs, and only up around 1.8 to 1.9% in the outer suburbs, which is considered the worst part of it.
Yeah.
So very low, under 2%.
Yeah. And Steph, a lot of the time when people are worried about taking a loan from a non-bank lender or not one of the major lenders, a lot of their judgment of risk, this is coming back to what I was talking about earlier, people's ability to judge risk is actually not very good. People are worried about a risk that is not actually theirs.
Yep.
The risk is with the investor on the other side of it, not with the not with you, the borrower. So if you're worried about using a non-bank lender, don't worry about what the investor gets on the other side. The risk to you is probably the same as taking a loan from anyone.
Once you've settled that loan, you're locked in.
Exactly.
It can't be taken back.
You are the risk.
That's right. You're the risk to them, not them to you. Now, what they're going to do is they're going to price the home loan at your level of risk. So that's what the major banks are withdrawing from. They only want to lend to the best quality type of borrowers with secure incomes and that sort of thing. Anyone who writes a mortgage to someone who is self-employed with low income or a low doc or some other situation which is not quite ideal, they might pay a higher interest rate on their home loan by going with one of these other lenders. And these other lenders will have the ability to change their interest rate depending on the risk level of the borrower. So one will offer you an interest rate at, I don't know, 4.1. If you were a better candidate, then they'd offer you 3.9. And if you were a worse candidate, they'd offer you 4.4. They'll price it according to the risk. And that's where these types of lenders will be going. And that's going to be true of these lenders and also in the online space, whether it's peer-to-peer lending or other things like that.
The interesting...
Oh, no, go for it.
I was going to suggest the interesting thing with how well this is connected to the rest of the topics we talk about is because the major banks obviously aren't lending as much as they used to, and their business model's being encroached upon, as you've alluded to here, Joel. And major banks haven't been lending to developers for construction really at all in the last 6 to 12 months. And the data I saw the other week is that the share prices for the majors has dropped significantly in the last year or so.
Yeah, very much so.
You know, the majors are... considered, I guess, a safe hold for a lot of investors on the ASX. So you can sort of see how, you know, if you're an investor buying these major bank shares and now you're seeing these mortgages coming in from other people, it's having an effect not just if you're a borrower, but also if you're an investor in the banks.
But when I go to borrow at one of these newer type of companies that are coming into the market, should I be looking for something, you know, should I be making sure that there's, you know, I'm looking for the right principles that they've got, or, you know, is there anything that I should be looking at of these companies to say they're better than the other one?
I think the best thing to do is to go to a mortgage broker. A really good mortgage broker would have these lenders along with the majors or as options for you and would be able to tell you the pros and cons.
For each individual, the principal thing is the interest rate. If it's giving you a better interest rate than the one next door, well, then that's probably going to be the right thing for you.
One other thing that can have an impact is borrowing capacity too. Sometimes some of these second-tier lenders will give you a higher LVR, a higher amount of borrowings.
That's true.
Depending on your circumstances, that might be critical.
And that's certainly happening.
But it's a combination of those two. The loan-to-value ratio you can achieve and the interest rate.
Okay.
All right. Well, good topics this morning. Now, moving on to our fun topic for the week.
What's that?
You can't be serious. Now, I heard you guys have a few good ones this morning. So, Brett, we might throw over to you.
Okay. Well, oh, China. I love you, China. You keep bringing up some great stuff. Now, last year, Beijing introduced a law which says anybody who mocks the March of the Volunteers can be held in police detention for up to 15 days.
Wow.
And just this week, a young girl who was a video blogger in China was detained for 5 days for just putting a video blog up of herself, which was deemed to be disrespectful to the national anthem.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow.
Right.
I don't think I'd want to be in there for 15 days with them.
No.
Love your country.
Yeah. I love them. Yeah. Be patriotic. Yeah. Yes.
Love with the iron fist. I've got one as well. YouTube. I don't know if anyone knows, but YouTube had an outage on Tuesday. So where do you think they went? When all the people couldn't actually use their YouTube and Google and do their searching through YouTube, where do you think that those
searching
searches,
for videos?
Yeah, search, where do you think those searches went?
Offline.
Yeah, I'm sure they opened a good novel.
Yeah. Well, it was a boon for Pornhub. Apparently, with YouTube crashing on Tuesday, Pornhub's visits jumped by 21% while the outage was taking place. And wow. Then as soon as YouTube got back up and running again, visits dropped back to their normal level.
My goodness.
Going from watching cat videos to watching pussy videos. Oh,
Louis, God.
That's a new low.
I had to say it. I had to say it.
You cannot be serious.
And also, we've heard about, fireman calendars. We've heard about police calendars,
We're not going to make one, are we?
Swimsuit calendars.
I hope not.
Financial advisor calendar. Yeah.
What about a Vladimir Putin calendar? Get your top off. So, yeah, Vladimir Putin, the Russian strongman and president, is at it again. He's taking his top off for the good of the country.
Wow.
Trying to lift morale.
Wow.
And yes, he's put out his 2019 calendar with 12 months or so of Vladimir.
12
Putin.
Months.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
I'll have to get my hands on that calendar.
I have a few right-wing friends in America who I might buy that calendar for.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And it sort of reminds me of that calendar that we saw in Italy, where we had the hottest priests in Italy calendar.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's something they really want to go on.
And what, dressed or?
They were dressed.
They were dressed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
If anyone's going to be a great sexual icon, it's an Italian Catholic priest. So,
have you just given away what our Christmas presents are?
How did you know? Well, look, thanks, guys, for all your input today. Another great podcast. And I hope you really enjoy your weekend, because it's going to be a top of 29, I think.
Beautiful.
Today.
Go Melbourne.
A really nice weekend. So we'll speak to all our listeners again next week. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks, Steph.
Bye.